On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Jesse Owens, David Lytle, and Charles Cook about Arminian Baptists. So we cover all sorts of topics like what is the general free will Baptist tradition? When did it begin? Is this coextensive with the Calvinist streams? Did it start later, earlier, or is it completely different? When did the general and free will Baptist terms begin to be applied and used? What does Arminianism really mean? Do all general and free will Baptists think the same? Who are some important figures in the general Baptist tradition? And why aren't more Baptists or Arminian Baptists popular today? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. We think the church has lacked serious answers to serious questions, and so we want to sort of resource that for those who listen. But we also want to develop and encourage an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So when we looked around, and me and Brandon, who started the podcast, and realized, you know what, there's just a lack of careful thinking about things. We didn't want just critical thinking. We also wanted virtuous thinking. We wanted a thinking that was charitable towards others, that was curious in what they believed and why they believed it, and to have sort of more of a dialogue rather than a lockdown attack debate. I like debates, but in the right spirit and the right way. So today, I am thrilled to introduce you all to a couple of guys. So, number one, you know Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens is going to be on the show with us today. He's technically a guest, but he's been on the show enough to where he could host it if he wanted to. So, Jesse is pastor and professor in Nashville. He's down at Welch College. And if you guys don't listen to Generally Particular, you should. It's also on YouTube. Go check it out. But I also have David Lytle and Charles Cook with us. I'll let them introduce themselves. David, if I mispronounced your last name, I realized that on air that I didn't think to ask for it. So here we are. David, I'll let you go first. Tell me about yourself and if I got your name right.
Okay. Yes, you did mispronounce it. It's Lytle, but that is fine. Everybody does it.
Everybody now knows it is Lytle and they won't forget it. So you're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, sir. So yeah, I am a history teacher in Riverside, California. I did go to Welch College and have studied history, and now I'm a PhD student at Gateway Seminary, Southern Baptist Seminary in Southern California. I spent some time as a missionary teaching. I was a teacher, history teacher in Indonesia and Peru. Been through a lot of life. I'm 41 years old now, and there's a whole nother, a lot of life story I could give you, but we're not going to do that. We're just going to nerd out. So anyway, that's a little bit about me.
Yes, Charles Cook, and I live in Cookeville, Tennessee, and I'm an English teacher there. Teach middle school English. Also teach online as an adjunct for Randall University out of Oklahoma, and teach philosophy, some ethics, and some biblical studies courses for them. Also attended Welch, where I got a degree in English secondary ed. Went on and studied at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary part-time for a couple of years at their Charlotte campus while I worked for the Billy Graham Association, and then went to Duke University where I worked with the historian Grant Wacker and got a Master of Theological Studies degree from there, and then came back to Cookeville, my hometown, and pastored my home church for about 9 years. And the past 4 years, I've been using that English degree teaching, and for two of the past 4 years, I've also been a bivocational pastor at a little church in town. So that's kind of my background right there.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. So we're going to be talking about a book that they co-edited together, David and Charles did, called Arminian Baptist, A Biographical History of Free Will Baptists. Jesse wrote several chapters in this book as well. And you know, it's funny, we're talking about this, like, as the day of this recording, I feel like a week ago, somebody was asking, hey, what are resources on Arminian Baptists? And it seems like there really aren't a lot of resources. A lot of the energy has been focused on the so-called particular Baptists and their history. So this should be fun to talk a little bit about Free Will Baptists, General Baptists. So maybe we begin with just, you know, when I say the terminology of Free Will Baptist or Arminian Baptist, what is that tradition referring to? When did it begin? How did it begin? Is this coextensive with what people think of when they think of particular Baptists? Is this distinct? Those related questions. David, I don't know if you want to take a first crack at it, and then Jesse and Charles, you're welcome to fill in any gaps, or you can tell us if David's gotten it right.
Oh, gosh. I was going to let Jesse talk, so, but I'll do a little bit on this. The first Baptist congregation that most historians recognize is going to be in England, starting with Thomas Helwys. And he came, you know, he was connected to John Smith. They were a separatist group. They went to the Netherlands for a while, and then they came back to England. Helwys led his group back to England and started a Baptist congregation. And one of the things about that congregation was that they were also Arminian, in, or at least broadly Arminian. That term is going to be hard to really kind of nail down, especially at this time, which we're talking just a few years after the Synod of Dort. So the terminology is not kind of really well established at that point. But they were definitely more believing Christ's death for all and those sorts of things. So that's kind of when the Baptist tradition begins. A few years later, another separatist church is more Calvinistic, and they become what we know as the particular Baptist. And then in the 1640s is when you start seeing groups coming along led by Thomas Lamb and Henry Dinn, who are preaching Christ's death for all and who are preaching believers' baptism. And so those are, you know, there's no denomination, there's no, you know, there's not a lot of formal structure behind those things, which makes things really messy, for sure, for historians. And there's a lot of different interpretation on how to get into all, you know, those groups, how to actually define them. But certainly by the end of the 17th century, you are seeing the standard confession or the brief confession of General Baptist being used pretty widely. And you're seeing, you know, associations that are kind of binding themselves based on their belief in believers' baptism and based on their belief in Christ's death for all, as kind of two major linchpins for what they believe and how they're organizing themselves. Jesse, why don't you correct me on all that kind of stuff?
No, I don't have anything to correct. The only thing I would add to that is, so obviously David has talked about the Helwys Church. And obviously after Thomas Helwys, you have John Merton, who's a significant early English General Baptist. And then by the 1650s, you have sort of the General Assembly of General Baptist. And then by 1660, you have the confession and a brief confession or standard confession, which David mentioned. For how this connects, though, for how the General Baptist tradition connects with Free Will Baptist, which is kind of one of the things that we're talking about. And it's sometimes referred to as the General Free Will Baptist tradition by Baptist historians. In the American South, you have the use of some versions of or abbreviated versions of the Standard Confession among some General Free Will Baptists by the mid-1700s and going into the 19th century for sure. So there are some sort of genetic connections, and then there's some sort of theological, ideological connections to General Free Will Baptist in the South. And there's some correspondence right around the turn of the century between the 1600s and going into the 1700s between General/Free Will Baptist in America, in the colonies, and the English General Baptist, at least the General Association of General Baptists. There's a split between the General Assembly and the General Association right around the 1700s.
So I've got to know, David, you mentioned terminology of like the extent of the atonement essentially was a big distinguishing factor. Are there other things that you would say this is distinguishing Arminians from more Calvinistic Baptists?
Yeah, that's it's a good question. There's a recent article by historian Stephen Holmes that actually tries to argue that the 17th century General Baptists weren't theologically Arminian. I don't know. I think there's definitely debate on that. So the term Arminian can kind of it has less specific meaning in a lot of ways. Because, and this is kind of what I'll say about a lot of this conversation, it lacks the institutional kind of force behind, when you have the Reformed churches and the Dutch Reformed churches and then the Westminster Confession in England, you really have, here are the parameters of what it means to be Calvinist. And you have these confessional documents, whereas you lack that with Arminianism. And so, what does it actually mean? And I think you could definitely call a lot of these people like Thomas Grantham, who will talk about Arminian in their theology. But there's not as many kind of boxes to check that this is what it means. So I think you find probably a more theological diversity. One thing, one chapter I wrote in this is on Thomas Lamb, this early proponent for baptism by immersion, perhaps the first, according to some historians, he's the first to propose baptism by immersion in the English context, English Baptist context. So Lamb hated the term Arminian and hated to be associated with it. He wrote books against an Arminian theologian, John Goodwin, who was an independent in London at the time, and really kind of railed against him. And it's very, it's a very polemical age, the 1640s. It's in the middle of a war, right? Or this was actually right after the Civil War, but it's a very divisive time. It's kind of like Twitter. There's a lot of overlap, but he really hated the term Arminian, but he still was going to die on the hill of Christ died for all. In a way that Calvinists would not accept, and so he sort of is a man without a country in the sense of he's not going to be accepted by the particular Baptist. He never even signs a confessional document associated with the general Baptist, although a lot of what he started and the momentum he started really lays the groundwork for this General Baptist denomination that emerges. So I guess the answer, to the question is there is probably a lot of theological diversity that's coming out of this movement, probably which to some General Baptists leads to some heretical ideas with Christology later on in the century with Matthew Caffin. But overall, I think just not having those kind of the institutional force of things like this is what the state says we believe, or this is what the Westminster Confession or whatever it is, it leads to a good bit of theological diversity, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It can just be taken in bad directions.
I think general atonement is a huge part of that, and David is right to point that out. I think conditional election, if we're looking at the confessional statements, conditional election seems to be there pretty consistently in the confessional statements. Just the general idea of the resistibility of grace to an extent is there. In fact, even in Helwys's confession in 1611, which is a confession attributed to his entire congregation, is the possibility of falling from grace. As well, that I wouldn't say that belief is necessarily universal, but you do find it, I think, in the confessional statements, and you find it even from the earliest instance there with Helwys. So those are all key components that might distinguish general Baptists from particular Baptists, and there are others that we could draw on, things that are distinct to them. One of the things that the general Baptist debate in the mid 17th century, which is really hot. And a big source of tension and debate is how to read Hebrews 6 and the laying on of hands. That's a big thing that they debate and people fall on different sides about. But yeah, I mean, there is a connection, I think, with Arminius And the early Remonstrants, not the later Remonstrants, because they kind of go astray on some key things. But there is some continuity, I think, with the Reformed tradition, with Arminius himself, and you see it in some of the confessional statements too.
Okay, I was going to ask about John Davenant and hypothetical universalism, and see like how close are some to saying yes, that would be an appropriate way to think. Is that I guess maybe not an appropriate way, but is that a within the bounds of what you could confess as an Arminian or General Baptist, Davenant's hypothetical universalism? I don't know. If you're not super familiar with Davenant's stuff, that's fine. We can move on. But that's just in my mind of what I'm thinking about.
Jordan, I've had the same question. I just don't know the answer to the question.
Okay, cool.
And Jesse knows a lot more about Monk than I do, but I see a similar way of thinking in Lamb and in kind of his successor is Henry Dinn. And both of those guys really make an impact on the early movement in the 1640s and 50s. And then they kind of pass off the scene, and the denominational movement kind of comes in the late 50s and 60s. And so, but those guys, I think, are a lot more along those lines of Amaraldian or hypothetical universalist. I see a little bit of that tradition in Monk. From what I've read of like the Monk's Orthodox Creed, but Jesse might disagree with me on that, but I just don't know. I have not found specific references to him in their writings, and they might exist. You know, I may have not been looking for him at the time when I was reading them, or I'm going back and reading some of that stuff. And I don't know. I don't know if there is a specific influence there, and I don't know if those guys influence Monk very much, but it seems like there's a strain of thinking that is similar to that, is more of an Amaraldian approach to salvation than a traditional Arminian or Calvinist one.
Yeah, that's something I'd have to give some more thought to. I've obviously read Monk very closely, but I haven't given a lot of thought to the Davenant connection. I keep telling myself I'm going to buy that Davenant volume in the Oxford Historical Theology series.
Way too expensive.
I think you've had the author of that on here, it's in my Amazon wish list. I just haven't pulled the trigger on that yet. But I haven't seen any references to Davenant. But that's not to say that maybe some haven't read it. My guess is though that it's probably just a more general sort of Arminian approach to general atonement. But it's worth looking into. I do know that there is some discussion of this. I think David referenced a moment ago an article from Stephen Holmes recently, and I want to say that he says that Clint Bass, in his book on Thomas Grantham, maybe traces some sort of hint of hypothetical universalism in one General Baptist theologian. I don't know that it's Grantham. It might have been Monk, but that's not something I've given a lot of thought to. I need to look into that more.
Yeah, the person you're referencing is Michael Lynch. So if you're listening and you want to go listen to it, he talked to us about hypothetical universalism and John Davenant, and how that contrasted with Owen's death and in the death of Christ and such. And if you have institutional access, I'll mention this for all you guys who have university access of some sort. Oxford typically puts those volumes online for free if you have institutional access, where you can get those PDFs. So if it's an Oxford series, oftentimes you can circumvent the $120 hardback price if you're okay with a PDF. So maybe that's an approach you can go, because I found the volume very, very enlightening, and I feel that Michael Lynch is one of those uniquely passionate people to listen to. So I enjoy his stuff.
If this is who I'm thinking about, I want to say I actually presented a paper 1 year at ETS on John Goodwin, and I think it was in the same section as him, and he was very exciting to listen to.
he was very
passionate.
I do have a question about these terms we've used: general free will, Arminian. Are these terms are we safe saying they're roughly synonymous? And maybe the question, or maybe I guess maybe the answer is, they weren't synonymous. Now they functionally are. Whoever wants to take that.
So our general free will and Arminian are, I'm probably using them synonymously. I think if we were to ask the whole historical component, like when are these words first used and things like that, typically free will Baptist, I think in the American context is the term is used in a pejorative way to reference Arminian Baptist in the American context. And then they sort of embrace that. Obviously, you have General Baptist referred to as General Baptist in the English context, certainly in the 18th century. We can think about later, you know, with Dan Taylor and the New Connection and things like that. You do have the term actually used. And I've actually seen a couple of occasions, even in the 17th century, where Arminian Baptist or General Baptist might refer to Calvinist Baptist as particulars. So there is something of that already there. But when I think about when I think about General Baptist or the general free will Baptist tradition, sometimes I'll say, and others use that terminology, I am thinking of those as synonymously. But I think as David and everyone else will point out, how Arminianism is used is really notoriously broad and is probably unhelpful. There's a lot of divergence and disagreement on this. I do see within the General Baptist tradition, certainly in the 17th century, and in figures like Thomas Monk, but also in Thomas Grantham, and even in Thomas Helwys, a significant drawing on, I think, the theology of Arminius. At least there's a consistency between the two. And so sometimes in the circles of folks that I interact with, we might call this Reformed Arminianism. And that's to sort of make a connection between Arminianism as we affirm it and a continuity between Arminius himself that differs from some maybe Wesleyan forms of Arminianism, 18th century, 19th century forms of Arminianism. So I'm using those terms sort of synonymously, what you mentioned earlier. But obviously there's a significant amount of variety when other people are using them, for sure.
Yeah. The term Arminianism really, yeah, it is tricky. And I think a lot of people in this book, especially early on, would not like to be associated with the term. And it's mostly just because of their context polemically. You think about the early or the 17th century when there's an Archbishop Laud that really is pushing a lot of high church and you could even say sort of Catholic leaning policies into the Church of England. And of course, the Puritans are reacting heavily to that. Most of the Puritans are pretty Calvinistic, although you have people like Goodwin that aren't. And so to be Arminian for most people at that time was to be on the wrong side politically as well. And so you're really going to have a lot of people running away from it. And then even in the 18th century, like you mentioned Dan Taylor, Jesse, and I just took a seminar on Andrew Fuller and studied kind of his exchanges with Taylor. And for Fuller, when he would list heretical views, you know, so Fuller's a particular Baptist, really influential. You know, he has a list, and it's Arianism, Socinianism, and Arminianism is the way he, you know, or something like that, or like Universalism and Unitarianism and Arminianism. They would always kind of fall in these views, and that's kind of his thinking. And even Taylor's not running around saying, "Hey, I'm Arminian." He would say, "Oh, I don't like these labels. I'm just looking at the scripture." So I think that's a lot of times what you'll see. So it's hard to really just give a label to this in that sense. And even like Jesse pointed out, the term free will Baptist starts off as an insult and it gets accepted a little bit later on. I actually really kind of prefer the term General Baptist, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't born and raised in a General Baptist house. I was, you know, my parents were actually free will Baptist missionaries. I didn't get to choose the name.
Understood. So I'd love for each of you to give me just a couple minutes on particular one of the figures that maybe you wrote a chapter on. I know some of you wrote more chapters, so you can just pick one that you'd like to talk about. And give me just like that little bit, like you don't have to tell me their whole life story, but just like situate their context, and then tell me a little bit about the importance for why they matter for either Baptists today or even non-Baptists, because we have a lot of people who aren't Baptists who listen, and just give them like, actually, you should care about this person because of X, Y, or Z.
I enjoyed one individual that I wrote about, and that was E.L. St. Clair. And this sort of gets to the question of what do Free Will Baptists, General Baptists, Arminianism, is that designating the same thing? And E.L. St. Clair, there's some things he has going on that remind us, well, not even the designation Free Will Baptist means the same thing to each person you're talking about. There are some things they have in common, like the extent of the atonement. But St. Clair, there are a lot of things that he would believe that are similar to folks today that call themselves Reformed Arminians that he had an agreement. But he had a view of original sin that is different than what you're going to read in a Leroy Four Lines or Matt Pinson, who's done a lot of work in his Free Will Baptist Handbook, at least the first edition, where Pinson talks about what Free Will Baptists have believed. E.L. St. Clair has, at least in one sermon that he preached, that apparently was it was put in pamphlet form, and apparently he preached it to some popularity, according to the back of one of the pamphlets. And he just had a different vision of original sin and inherited sin, and really rejected the idea of inherited sin and had a different explanation for that. So I fall more in the Reformed Arminian camp, but it was enlightening to read how he presented his views, and helpful as a historian to see, like, okay, this is a way that Free Will Baptist doctrine has either developed, or ways that they veered away from what Grantham or maybe even some of the confessions said. And then later on through Leroy Four Lines, Robert Pickering, and some others, how they have realigned back with Arminius and Grantham and some of these guys. So I found St. Clair just instructive. He also planted a lot of churches and debated, in the best use of that word, debated other folks from other theological backgrounds and wrote quite a bit. So I found him really helpful for understanding the context of Free Will Baptist prior to the formation of the National Association, which happened in the 1930s, and he's kind of operating right before that.
All right, let me just give you a quick flyover of the book, and then I'll dive into somebody. So what it is, it's just a collection of biographies, and we edited it. We got different scholars to contribute, and it sort of starts with 17th century General Baptist, which is what we've been talking about mostly, and then it goes to the American context of Free Will Baptist denomination, which is a smaller denomination, but most Baptist denominations are small unless you're the SBC. And there are Baptist denominations that aren't SBC. No offense. So that's, it's a biographical history. So it's going to give these major figures. And for us, we wanted to do this as kind of an introduction because of being in a small denominational context, we just don't have as much, we don't have seminaries that have scholars that are constantly pushing out books on our history. And I came up with the idea of reading a Baptist history book, and I love Baptist history, and thinking, well, there's a story that's particular to our context that just doesn't get told. So let's tell it, and let's talk about these people. So that's kind of the idea. And the idea is, how can we introduce people to the major characters and invite them to further research? So what we'd love to do is people say, hey, I'm usually it's going to be people that are already influenced by this tradition and say, I'd love to pick up more and study this person or this person or this person. So one of the ones that I wrote on is Paul Palmer. And Paul Palmer is one of those big links between the English General Baptist and the American Free Will Baptist. He comes to the U.S. He comes to North Carolina. He preaches all around North Carolina, Maryland. He actually visits the Charleston Church, which is a Calvinist Baptist church in South Carolina. But he visits there. They have sort of an Arminian remnant, a General Baptist remnant there in Charleston. So they're confessionally Calvinist, but they're the only Baptist church in town, and there's not a lot of options in colonial South Carolina. So he visits them. This is in the 1720s that he's really active and just is preaching all over the Carolinas as well as other colonies. The church that he started is Southern Baptist. It's the first Baptist church in North Carolina, but it's now Southern Baptist. But he really did start a movement of he was a General Baptist. He brought over, and his family's, you know, had Grantham's theology there that they kind of referred to, and so he brings over General Baptist ideas into the colonies and really sets the groundwork for what becomes the Free Will Baptist Churches in North Carolina, which North Carolina has been a stronghold for the Free Will Baptist denomination more so than other states. So anyway, Paul Palmer is a significant figure in Baptist history as a whole, but specifically with general Free Will Baptist history.
Yeah, one of my chapters is on Thomas Monk, who is a significant English General Baptist. He is living in the mid-17th century, and probably the two most important works that he's involved in writing are, the first one is A Cure for the Cankering Error of the New Eutychians, and there's more to it than that. That's just the sort of abbreviated title. Monk is, he's a farmer, theologian, and he's both of those things. He's a farmer and a significant theologian. He draws on not only the Reformed tradition, but he's clearly been exposed through source books or in some way to Nicaea, Chalcedon, Constantinople, and early church theologians. And so in A Cure for the Cankering Error, Monk is living in an age in which there is in England a rise of anti-Trinitarianism and heretical Christology. And he marshals the arguments, the language of Nicaea and Chalcedon, to argue against these heretical Christologies. And within, among the General Baptists, Matthew Caffin is a significant figure and is for over half a century. But there are claims that Matthew Caffin affirms heterodox Christology. And I think in part, Monk is responding to Caffin's heterodox Christology with this massive work, just... again, drawing on the tradition in a variety of ways and giving this incredibly complex response to these various heretical Christologies, and then also giving a positive presentation of Orthodox Christology that's really significant. He's also involved in the development of an Orthodox creed, which is signed by at least 55 General Baptists in the Midlands there in England. It's not adopted as the confession of the General Assembly, but it is significant. And within that work, you see the contextual nature of it there as well, because there are multiple articles dealing with Christology. So you can sort of see the contextual nature. But again, Monk just marshals the language of Nicaea, Chalcedon, and the early church fathers and the Reformed tradition to argue for Orthodox Christology in a very nuanced, precise way, which again, to me, is always so amazing. Again, thinking about his situation of growing up in the house of a farmer, being a farmer, but also being a theologian. There's also this really interesting account that I think your listeners might be interested in, with Thomas Monk and William Kiffin. There are some Baptists imprisoned in Aylesbury, and there's some debate about whether Monk is imprisoned or whether Monk goes to find Kiffin. But anyways, it seems as if Monk sets out, goes to London, locates William Kiffin, and then William Kiffin, who's very wealthy and very well-connected, as a particular Baptist, then basically pulls some strings and has these Baptists in Aylesbury released from prison. But I think one of the things that your listeners, though, could draw from this is thinking about Thomas Monk as just an average pastor in sort of an agrarian context, but then has somehow achieved this great level of learning and is able to put together these complex treatises and confessions of faith to deal with these very serious but nuanced issues of his own day by drawing on the best parts of the Christian tradition, I think is instructive for all of us who have much more access to resources than someone like Thomas Monk would have. But he's significant in the English General Baptist tradition in the 17th century, but I think going into the American context as well.
I think it might be good for your listeners too. Jesse, he made a comment that I fully agree with about we have so much more ease of access to researching and just all sorts of materials, just that online now, if you know where to look, you can find all sorts of things. And part of the struggle with Free Will Baptist history in the past has been, really, it's just been recently through the work of Robert Piccirilli and the Historical Association of the National Association, which again wasn't founded until the 1930s, and it took later before the Historical Commission really got going. They have done a lot of work in compiling our history and the documents that have made this kind of work then possible. And you combine that with the work done in the English General Baptist and particular Baptist tradition, all the great work done in the last century and the beginning of this century has made this type of research and a more complex and nuanced understanding of Baptist history in general, Free Will Baptist history in particular, has made it much more possible. So we live in a moment where a lot of resources are now available that previous historians didn't have, especially in the Free Will Baptist tradition, because in the South, at least, we just didn't have academic institutions where people were doing that type of work. Most of our pastors in the Southern tradition were either farming, lots of them were farmers, and they just didn't have time or access to these type of things. So there's a reason why this work has emerged at this moment in our history, and a lot of it has to just do with the resources are available to us now to be able to do it.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
I'm sorry, Jordan. We're cutting you off. It's like you're not even in charge of this thing. We're just taking over. It's a mutiny here. No, I'm
well,
sorry.
Would my will be subservient to yours in some sense? You know.
First of all, Jordan, let me say this. I have yet to say this, and we're like 50 minutes in. I'm a big fan, actually. I listen to nearly every London Lyceum podcast, so I'm a fanboy. I'm getting to hang out with my favorite rock band from high school.
I think David might actually be a paid subscriber. I could be wrong.
Oh, here we go.
I am. I have paid my $3. That's coming out of my bank account. There's a couple things that I want to say as far as the Charles's point, and just to build on the things that have been said. I realize as I'm a historian or aspiring historian or whatever I am, institutions are so significant, right? And we don't think about it. I remember a podcast interview. I don't think it was your podcast, but it was with Keith Stanglin, who wrote with Thomas McCall. He's written two books on Jacob Arminius and another one on after Arminius. And I remember him talking about how Richard Moeller, their advisor, told Stanglin, you should research Arminius, which is kind of surprising coming from Moeller, right? And they're at Calvin College, and it's not really what people do there. But his point was, no one else has researched this. And it is interesting to think, when you think about the age-old Calvinism-Arminian debate, there are scores or thousands of books on Calvin's theology, right? The amount of actual academic work on Arminius's theology, probably 2-3 books, at least recently, recent academic works. So my point is institutions really matter. And so that's one reason why we want to do this, is to get this out and have people that are maybe connected to our tradition or care about our tradition really follow up with academic research that is meaningful. The other thing I was going to say, as far as people, I think we have to mention, and I know his name has been mentioned, but Robert Piccarelli is a Free Will Baptist scholar. He's older now. He's published more books in his retirement than he has in his when he was active, you know, teaching. And he wrote and contributed to our book. He did a bunch of historical research just for the archives, and we also spotlight him in one of the articles because he is a really solid, if you're looking for a resource on Arminian Baptist theology, I mean, his books like Grace, Faith, Free Will are just very accessible, but also really solid. He's a great exegete. He's a Bible, you know, top-notch Bible scholar, and I think he does a great job. So I think I just want to throw out his name in there just because we all really appreciate his stuff and it would be a good resource.
Awesome. So you did mention this idea of institutions and the necessity of them. And does that mean that the reality, Arminian Baptists, I feel like, don't have the same sort of research dedicated to them as more Calvinistic Baptists? Is that part of the reason? Is because Arminian Baptists, for whatever reason, don't have the same institutional structure? Or are there other external factors that have contributed to less research on them?
I can give you and I'm not claiming this is an all-encompassing answer, because I'm sure it's not, but here are several factors that have contributed to the lack of research. And another question that you had sent us ahead of time, of like, why are there fewer Arminian Baptist congregations that identify that way? So here are just a couple of things that contribute to that. One, your listeners may or may not know that the Northern Free Will Baptist movement did have a number of colleges. Hillsdale College was started by Free Will Baptists. There was Cobb Divinity School in Maine, and several others, and they had a fairly robust intellectual tradition that was being birthed during the 1800s. And then in the 1900s, early 1900s, the Northern Free Will Baptist movement merged with Northern Baptist. And when they merged with Northern Baptist, they lost their distinct identity. And the American Baptist, I believe it's still called the American Baptist denomination of today, are the heirs of that Northern Baptist movement. So when that merger occurred, they lost those institutions, and they lost the majority of their churches in that merger. They just lost their distinct identity. So that the loss of the whole Northern movement, eradicated, I don't know if half's the right answer, but it eradicated the whole Northern half. And they were strong in parts of the Northeast, really on this side of the eastern side of the Mississippi River. They had a strong tradition. They were very involved in the anti-slavery movement. Some of the strongest abolitionists were found in the Northern Free Will Baptist movement. And so, you have the beginning of the 20th century, that whole tradition just disappears. And, becomes emerged within the Northern Baptist. So you have that happening. In the South, those first congregations by Palmer, most of them, and I think Jesse and Dave, they can give more detail on this if they want to, but they, Calvinist preacher came to North Carolina, and I don't know if you want to use the word converted or what word we want to use, but some of those early congregations, they moved into Calvinism away. So some of those first congregations were lost. Then it seems like as Free Will Baptists get going in the South, then a number of ministers and congregations, they move over to the Church of Christ as that movement begins to really explode in the Southeast. Then you have the Civil War, which kind of stops everybody. And then in North Carolina, you do get right at the end of the 1800s, beginning the 1900s, You get a seminary started there. It provided elementary and high school education. They had a theological course for ministers, and that begins to develop. And then the Great Depression hits, and the institution goes under. So all those things contribute to why we don't have the intellectual tradition here in America. Those are all contributing factors. And then, and this might be a little more debated, when we do get institutions going, the National Association is formed in the 50s and 60s and 70s. The Independent Baptist movement has a big influence on Free Will Baptist. And I think in some ways, Free Will Baptists maybe limited themselves. Some congregations and even within the hierarchy, I don't know if hierarchy is the right word, but there became a lot of rules. And if you didn't check these maybe unwritten rules off, you might not have felt comfortable in a Free Will Baptist church during that time period. And I think that probably hurt us some as well, how some of that played out. So all those things are contributing factors, I think. You know, Dave, Jesse, what do you guys, how would you answer that?
Well, before they go, Charles, I had a follow-up on the story you told about the Northern Baptists and how they merged and lost that identity. What was the rationale behind the merger?
Well, so a couple of things. So think about the main barriers to merger, the act of feet washing. So for many Free Will Baptist churches, the majority, I think you could say, practice feet washing. And so that was true in the North at first, but over time that became less and less and less. So this sort of outward ritual that you would do disappears among the Northern, or among many Northern Free Will Baptists. The same time that is happening, many Northern Baptists begin to adopt open communion. And so when you adopt open communion, I mean, that was a big barrier. If Free Will Baptists are saying, hey, open communion, as long as you're a Christian, you're here, you can do this. If other Baptists are saying, no, you cannot, you know, we're not going to practice open communion. But as open communion began to get adopted, that removed another barrier between the two groups. And then this is where we need more research. But one of the big leaders in the Free Will Baptist movement was Alfred Williams Anthony, who studied with Harnack in Germany. He taught, I believe, at Cobb Divinity School. He was very involved in the institutions of the Northern Free Will Baptist movement. And he really bought into the unity ecumenical spirit that was really exploding in the early 1900s. And he really pushed this merger and this idea of, hey, the reasons that we've been separate no longer exist. And so he, you know, Williams promoted that. And I think sometimes Williams is presented as this boogeyman that he forced the group to do it. I don't think that's true. I think he did promote it and he was the biggest pusher of it. But clearly there were others who were ready to go along with this and ready to merge. So those factors, I think the disappearance of feet washing, the Northern Baptists, many of them embracing open communion, and then this ecumenical spirit, and you had a big pusher of it in Williams on the Free Will Baptist side, all those things contributed to that merger. And there's a social factor. I mean, I personally, there is. After the Civil War, the nation's trying to bind itself, and that cultural, social movement of these divisions are not good and the nation's got to bind itself. You know, I think it's hard for us to appreciate how strong that was and how this generation after the Civil War, many of them felt like, yeah, we've got to do this because we don't want this type of division to happen again. And so you've got this social current that I think is also feeding into, hey, it'd be better if Christian groups could unify instead of emphasizing our differences.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So as we come to a close with this episode, I'd love to hear each of you a little bit just on what you think the future of Arminian Baptist looks like. Maybe that's you're giving advice for saying, I want more people to research this, or maybe it's sort of like a predictive prophecy. I'm kidding. But you get the idea. Like, what does the future look like? What do you hope it looks like?
I'll go first. I think we've seen a lot of promising things within our own tradition, within our own denomination over the last, 3 decades or so. Charles mentioned some of them, but I think that we have seen an increase in our circles of people getting higher levels of education and getting involved in scholarship in various fields, some in historical theology, history, systematic theology, all sorts of things. And I think that's significant for us as a movement to do work in theology, to do work in history, to do work in other fields. And so I think that's a big component. One of the things that I've been really encouraged by and has been a significant part of my own life is the recovery of the General Baptist tradition and that connection with Free Will Baptists in America, which this book does a lot for the lay level person in creating or making those connections clear. I think that Charles mentioned Robert Piccirilli. I think David mentioned Leroy Fourlines earlier. Those are two significant theologians in the last 50 to 60 years for our movement. And the idea of Reformed Arminianism or Reformation Arminianism, that is distinct from Wesleyan Arminianism, the recovery of that, I think the growth of interest in that. There are a lot of people in the SBC, I think, responding to what they feel like is sort of a resurgence, at least was a resurgence of Calvinism within the denomination, in the conservative resurgence and sort of then beyond that, have started reading Piccirilli, have started reading Fourlines. So you have a lot of SBC folks who would not identify as Arminian Baptists, but they are drawing heavily on these theologians and in many ways on our tradition. And that seems to be growing and increasing. And I find that encouraging, if not for people embracing it, which if I'm being honest, I hope more people do, but at least for the purpose of increased awareness of this tradition. David mentioned earlier, and I think it's sort of a funny little note, that in Fuller, you kind of get, Andrew Fuller, you get Socinianism, you know, Unitarianism, and Arminianism. Or he gives these lists, you know, of these sort of gross heresies, and Arminianism gets tossed in there. I think for a lot of Calvinists, whether we're talking about Presbyterians or Calvinist Baptists, that tends to be the idea that they have of Arminianism. There's sort of this boogeyman. But there is this more rich, textured, theologically reformed stream of Arminian thought that exists in the English General Baptist and then even to the present. And I hope that more and more people will become acquainted with that, rediscover that, and I hope people's interest in it grows.
Yeah, I just echo, I agree with everything Jesse just said. And I think, like Jesse, I've benefited from Robert Piccirilli and Leroy Fourlines. And one bright spot from today, I mean, probably Matt Pinson's done as much as anybody to make people outside our own movement aware of, you know, what our movement's about, and particularly the Reformed Arminian tradition. He's explained that well in lots of contexts. So I think the generation or two before me, especially if you were drawn to an intellectual tradition or even a historical tradition, might have felt like you didn't fit among Free Will Baptists because that tradition just wasn't there to the degree it is now. And so I do feel like a lot of people my age and lower, they feel like there's a place for them in Free Will Baptist, where maybe certain types of individuals with certain interests just maybe felt like they reached a dead end road with Free Will Baptist. They just didn't quite fit. And so I think that's a good thing. I think Arminian Baptists face the same difficulties that lots of groups now, and a lot of those have to do with challenges towards Christianity just in general. I think a really bright spot is overseas, the growth of Arminian Baptists and our mission works, particularly in India. There are a number of Russian Baptists that identify with the Arminian tradition, and I could give some other examples, but I think that is encouraging, and I think their example is actually strengthening those of us back here in the States, and I think that's a positive development as well.
Yeah, let me just quickly promote, if you're looking for another great resource, Matt Pinson, who we've talked about a little bit. His book, 40 Questions on Arminianism, is a very good book. It's in that series. I think the series is fantastic. It's real short chapters, just but really good content. He also wrote a couple chapters for our book, so you can buy both of those things. It would be fantastic. This doesn't totally answer. I'm not sure as far as what the future is. I do live in a place. I live out in California in a town. There's no Free Will Baptist churches around. I'm in a SBC church and happy there, and at an SBC seminary. So I'm kind of like have one foot in the door, one foot out. You know, being all the way out where I am, but just as far as the overall Arminian Baptist movement. One thing that was asked, I think, in one of the questions before we got going was, why is it not more popular these days? And in a way, it is.
Yeah.
If you think about what Thomas Helwys was standing up for, he was standing up for religious toleration. He was standing up for Christ's universal death and believers' baptism. Well, just about any non-denominational group or Pentecostal group believes all of those things. And those churches are exploding all over this country and all over the world. So no, there's not just there are Free Will Baptists that are growing in various pockets around the world, as Charles mentioned. But this tradition, which again, maybe when it comes to institutions, it might be kind of porous. But this tradition is quite large. The tradition of Christ, you know, universal atonement and believers' baptism, those things are very pervasive in the evangelical world. And even the church that I attend is you know, it's SBC, but those are kind of hallmarks of this church that I attend. And so I think that shows, no, maybe not a complete influence of the Free Will Baptist movement itself, but those ideas that the General Baptist started have not gone away, and I think the church is better for them because it's given a lot of missionary vitality to the global church.
Jordan, awesome. And you may not want to answer this, or maybe something to think about. I think it was in the early 2000s. And I believe his Lifeway did a study, and kind of at the heat of the whole Calvinism debate within the SBC. And I believe 10% of the pastors that they surveyed identified as Calvinist. What are the other 90%? Are they modified Arminians? Like I mean, I tend to look at what a lot of them espouse and preach and say, at least the ones I know. And I'm like, well, that's a modified form, like that's Arminianism plus eternal security. And I think there might even be some debate on what Arminius actually believed about that. But like, I'm like, well, some of this sounds like you're Arminian minus this one point. But the term Arminian is almost like the term Yankee was when I was a boy in the South. Like nobody wanted to be called a Yankee. Like that's the worst, you know, like that, and like Arminianism, that became a term that just encompassed everything wrong, you know, that a person thought was wrong was summed up in that word if you were a Southerner. And I at times feel like, well, and I think Roger Olson maybe has argued this of like, hey, I want you to know what Arminians believe, because more of you actually believe this than you're, you know, than you want to claim. So when I think about the tradition, I'm in complete agreement with Dave, like, these institutional denominations, I don't know what the future holds, but some of the key ideas espoused seem to be held by lots of Baptist lay people and preachers. I'm just curious. I mean,
yeah,
I'm on to something. Like, I don't know. It's something I've thought about.
In my quick take, I would say that eternal security piece is a major factor. So I would say if you ask them, like, hey, what is your theology? And you didn't put the terminology of Arminianism or Calvinism up there, it would probably be a significant check on the Arminian side, except on the eternal security piece. That would be like one of those things that they want to hold on to, I think. Though I do think the terms Arminian and Calvinist, both of them have their own baggage to where, depending on the context, if you use it, it's very much a pejorative and an untouchable. You don't want to be like those. I mean, I remember growing up, my mom, I guess my uncle became a Presbyterian, And so when I'm like asking her as a high school, like, what in the world is a Calvinist? That was a bad thing. Those were people who didn't want to evangelize. That was the reason they became Calvinists, was so they didn't have to share the gospel, those sort of things. So, like, depending on who you're talking to, I think both of those terms can be very bad, boogeyman-ish terms. So, yeah, that's my take anyway.
Okay.
But I appreciate you guys for doing this. This was a lot of fun. So what I'm telling you guys, for those who are listening, I'm going to put the book here, this particular one, The Arminian Baptist, plus Matt Pinson's 40 Questions on Arminianism. I'm going to put both of them in the description with links, so that what you can do is you can go buy the books, learn more, educate yourself, and you're also supporting good people who are trying to do good work to help them build more resources so that we can resource our own Baptist tradition and just the Protestant tradition in general. I mean, Jesse was mentioning that Thomas Monk volume on the cure for the cankering air. I mean, the classic 17th century title, but like that's just classic Christology there. So you're not only resourcing Baptist heritage, Arminian Baptist heritage, but just more generally Protestants in general. So go ahead and support them. Thanks for listening, as always, to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.